I've as usual, I've enjoyed, you know, sharing with you and being on the air with you. And I think one of the things that I'm hearing is also that we can start taking care of ourselves and other people before the crisis, before it gets to that level. I want to just end with this poem by Pablo Neruda. Like the earth, I belong to everyone. There is not a single drop of hatred in my breast. Open wide, my hands scatter grapes to the wind. Pablo Neruda. Thank you all. And, you know, take care of yourselves very, very well. Love yourselves very, very well. That opens the path to all else that we need. And, yeah, sometimes it's a struggle. The healing is a struggle and there's pain. But in the breaking open of that, we get our clear thought and our clear mind and our clear action. You all take care of yourselves very well. I love you. I love me. And until next time.
Just about 5 minutes after 1 o'clock, you're tuned to WBAI in New York. The program normally at this time is Weaponry. Tom Whisker is not here this week, and nor will he be here the next 2 weeks after this. My name is Emmanuel Goldstein, and we'll be trying to follow the same vein that Tom's show normally takes around this time. We won't be as specific as far as weapons and military details and things like that, but I certainly want to talk about the things that are happening in the world today, particularly things that are happening in Central America today, and the things that so far just aren't happening here. We'll be taking your phone calls. We'll be doing a lot of things. We'll run until 3:30. Our phone number is 279-3400.
Union Jack and Maggie, over lunch one day, took a cruiser with all her parents to make her give it back.
No! debate. I've spelled out my position. There will be no more debate.
With the music of Mikey Dread underneath us, and prior to that, a piece from Pink Floyd, Get Your Filthy Hands Off My Desert. Well, good morning to you. My name's Emmanuel Goldstein. You're listening to WBAI. I'm filling in for Tom Whisker this morning, and a lot of things going on in the world, a lot of historic events, historic happenings. 1989 is going to be one of those years that you just wonder, what was I doing? Where was I? What do I have to show for it? Well, folks, there are an appalling amount of nasty goings-on in the world, not a few of which this particular land that we are in right now is responsible for. One of which is what's happening in El Salvador. If you were looking at yesterday's newspaper, that is Tuesday's New York Times, you may have noticed an article about the killing of six priests in El Salvador about 2 weeks ago. And a woman described as a witness to those slayings, the slayings of six Jesuit priests, has provided the first sworn evidence linking the killers to the Salvadoran armed forces, and hence to the U.S. government. The judge investigating the slaying said today that he also thought that they had been committed by members of the armed forces. They were wearing camouflage uniforms, said the 44-year-old witness, Lucia Barrera de Cherna, in a sworn statement shown to reporters by the judge, Ricardo A. Zamora. Mrs. Barrera, who is now in the United States under the protection of the FBI after giving her deposition here, added that the uniforms were identical to ones she had frequently seen on soldiers in the street. Judge Zamora said, this was yesterday actually, that he had not received any information to contradict the widespread assumption that the slayings were carried out by members of the military or people linked to the armed forces. It's logical, he said in a 20-minute interview in his office. He noted that the killers were able to travel during a dusk-to-dawn curfew that is strictly enforced by the armed forces, and that army units surrounded the area at the time of the slayings. It probably was members of the military, but I can't discount any possibility, said the judge, who said he had been a close friend and student of one of the priests. The six priests, who were among the most eloquent supporters of a negotiated settlement to the decade-old civil war, were slain on November 16th at the University of Central America on the edge of the capital during a rebel offensive. I don't think we really need to hear much more to get the point across. That article in yesterday's New York Times pretty much says it all. There is little doubt that that the armed forces were behind that particular slaying. And you know what's interesting? What gets me the most, if you were listening to the radios, TVs, what have you, reading the newspapers only a week ago, you may have seen the reports of those rebel terrorists who took over the hotel. You know, they actually had the nerve, they had the gall to go in there and hold Americans hostage. I mean, it was the Ayatollah all over again. Are Americans going to just sit still and take this kind of garbage? Are we going to just allow these dirty foreigners to get away with these deeds, even if it's in their own home countries? Oh, I mean, talk about riling people up. Talk about getting everybody in a patriotic fervor. Boy, those nasty rebels. Now, it didn't matter that the people they were keeping an eye on, let's say, in the hotel were Green Berets, military people in themselves, military people in their own country. Now, you know, imagine, if you will, I mean, this is almost impossible to imagine, I realize, but imagine, say, a bunch of, all right, let's say Libyans, what the hell. Let's say a bunch of Libyans were here in New York, a bunch of Libyans with guns and things like that, right? guns and M16s, whatever you carry with you when you're a military person. They were just sitting in the Penta Hotel, okay? Across the street here, downtown Manhattan, sitting in the Penta Hotel with their, you know, machetes and guns and knives, whatever they have, you know, talking all their military talk about how they were going to make this country safe for Libyan interests. And then a bunch of our boys went in there and decided to run the check-in process for a little while. You know, answer the phones and, you know, call taxis for people and just sort of run the hotel for a little while. Well, that's kind of a similar type of a thing to what happened down in El Salvador last week. There were no actual hostage-taking incidents. Guns were not held to people's heads, and, you know, it wasn't what it was played out to be. And even if it was, for God's sake, look at what we're dealing with here. It's a war, you know? These things happen in a war. And for us to get so high and mighty about this, when we're the ones that have sent in the people in the first place that keep this war going, we get upset when they, you know, when people say, hey, you know, we don't like you all that much, and maybe we'll hit you or something. It's only been 2 weeks. 2 weeks since the Jesuit priests were murdered, and the story was buried before their bodies were. Now, whose fault is this? Is it our media? Is it our government? Or is it maybe ourselves? Maybe it's the fact that we just don't listen. We don't look. We don't learn. We don't have links to the past. We don't say, hey, only about 20 years ago, this same garbage was going on. Why don't we look at the parallels and see, you know, how maybe they interrelate, and maybe we can learn from our mistakes in the past and not repeat them again. You know, it'd be kind of nice. Good way to start the 90s. Well, folks, I know there's a bunch of people that are very dedicated. I've seen them. In fact, if I can find the little piece of paper here that I clipped from last week's paper about the demonstrators in Times Square. Oh, it's all the way over here. Here it is. 250 demonstrators protesting United States involvement in El Salvador briefly blocked the streets south of Times Square yesterday, snarling traffic during the evening rush hour. Carrying signs and chanting anti-war slogans, they broke through a cordon of police who had tried to confine their march to the sidewalk. About 75 police officers, many on motor scooters or in patrol cars, formed a ring around the marchers, preventing them from moving south on Broadway. The protesters then sat down in the street, and after several tense minutes of negotiations with police officers, the demonstrators returned to the sidewalk and marched peacefully to the Chrysler Building on 42nd Street, where Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan has an office. The New York Committee, in solidarity with the people of El Salvador, organized the protest. Well, apart from the fact that these three paragraphs in the paper were the only real mention of this event, 250 people in the city of New York City, only 250 people feel strongly enough about the killing that's going on in El Salvador to get out there and just march a little bit, let alone, you know, lie down in front of doors or participate in civil disobedience or something like that. But, I mean, you know, we're sponsoring things. I'm not going to say that the U.S. government went in there with the intention of killing six Jesuit priests, but indirectly, we're every bit as responsible as the people that pulled the triggers, because we're setting it up. We're setting it up in such a way that these things are just going to keep happening. It's really sad. Now, I understand that there's going to be some kind of a demonstration in the city on Saturday against U.S. involvement in El Salvador. And if you feel strongly at all, and even if you just have doubts, learn something by then, and, you know, maybe you'll be persuaded to take part in it. I don't have the full details. I'm in the process of trying to get the full details. And if you have some details, please call in with them, and we will spread them around. We got to do better than 250 people protesting a policy like this that allows a big, huge government like the United States government to go into a tiny country like El Salvador. And it would be unfair to say that we caused the hell that's going on there, but we certainly are allowing it to continue. Our number is 279-3400. We'll be taking your phone calls. It's something that, you know, I've always felt something about this issue, but it wasn't until the last few weeks, and there was a couple of things. It was the renewed fighting, obviously, that brought El Salvador back into the headlines, you know, at all. You know, for a while there, it wasn't even in the headlines. You know, where did it go? Where did the country go? It's still down there. You know, there's still people living in fear, just like, you know, in Lebanon. But it was recently that the fighting and the killing started again, the horrors and the atrocities. So that's going to sell some newspapers, so you read about it again. Unless you listen to a station like this, and you might hear about it a little bit more. But it wasn't just that. It was also the events taking place in Eastern Europe that got me thinking so much about what people can do when they set their minds to it. You know, when they say, enough already, we're not going to take this garbage. You know, we're going to go into the street, not just once, but every single day until there's a change, until something happens. Now, I was part of the march in Washington this spring for abortion rights, and that was incredible, to say the least. I believe we had about 500,000 people there, 500,000 people in Washington, D.C., the largest rally ever, from what I understand. And it was good. It was, you know, rejuvenating to be a part of that. But folks, we all went home on Monday. You know, we were there on Sunday, and we all went back on Monday, and that was it. Now, imagine if 500,000 people had marched in Washington, D.C. every damn day until something was done. I mean, they're doing that in Prague right now. At this very moment, there's probably a march going on in Prague of a couple of 100,000 people. I mean, there was an incredible general strike yesterday, which was incredibly successful. And there's a lot less people in Czechoslovakia than there are in the United States. The thing that it boils down to is the fact that we aren't focused enough. We're just not caring enough about this one particular issue. And perhaps that's the problem. Perhaps there are too many issues to think about, and we don't know where to focus our attention. Well, folks, I think this El Salvador policy is a good starting point. Let's wipe out that policy and take it from there, because, you know, justice is something that you got to fight for, and you got to argue for it, and you've just got to keep going and keep pushing until something happens, until something changes. It's never easy. I mean, here we don't really have to worry about putting our lives on the line. Maybe we'll spend a night or two in jail or something like that, but in other countries, in Eastern Europe, in Asia, you never really know what's going to happen. And when the victories are won over there, they mean an awful lot. And the people have an incredible spirit. And I think what's going to come out of all this is perhaps, regrettably, democracy will be cherished more in other countries than it is here, because we've grown complacent. We don't really think that there's anything to care about or to fight for or to worry about. You know, we're happy. We got our McDonald's, we got our HBO, we got our MTV, and the battle is won. Well, folks, I don't think so. I think the battle is being lost every day that we don't say something, every day that we just go to work and worry about our own petty concerns. Not to say that our concerns are trivial or meaningless, but there's a bigger picture, the picture of humanity. You know, the people you pass by in the street every day, we all have a common link And that common link extends all throughout the globe. And we've got to be a part of that. Whether it's caring for the environment, caring for what we're doing to some poor people some thousands of miles away or even hundreds of miles away, we've got to be aware of what's going on. Our number is 279-3400. I'd like to hear what people up at this time of night have to think. My name is Emmanuel Goldstein. I'm filling in for Tom Whisker tonight and for the next 2 weeks after that. And let's hear what you folks have to say. 279-3400. Good evening.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Thanks a lot for doing the program on this subject. I agree with you. It's really crucial. And I also agree that the activist response to U.S. intervention in El Salvador has not at all been adequate in New York City. Around the country, there's been dozens of demonstrations, some of them ranging up to 3,000 and 4,000 people in different cities. And so the demonstration this Saturday is called by a broad coalition of peace groups, and I do have the information on it, and it's a really, really important time for people to do a lot of outreach to make this the biggest thing yet, to raise a loud voice about what's happening there. It starts at 11 a.m. at the Times Square recruiting station, and there will be a brief rally there, and then it will be marching down later towards Union Square. I don't know exactly what time it will leave, but it will be going on for several hours. And besides the demonstration Saturday, there is also going to be a rally and a civil disobedience on Monday morning at the Federal Building downtown, and that will start at 8 a.m. And I believe it's Broadway and Reed Street.
I'm sorry, what day is that? Is that the same day?
No, that's Monday.
That's Monday. Okay. And that's a civil disobedience, and that will be taking place where again?
At the Federal Building, which is, hold on, it's at Broadway and Duane Street at 8 a.m.
Is this the biggest rally scheduled so far?
Yes, this is the biggest one in New York City, and it's been endorsed by dozens of groups, and hopefully there will be more follow-up activities after that, but this is the first step to really broadening out the protests.
Any estimate on how many people are expected?
Not really. It's always hard to predict in advance, but we're really hoping it'll be in the thousands.
More than 250.
Definitely. No, there's no question about that. I mean, because a lot of organizations are involved in building for this. And I could give out a phone number for more information if people would like.
Well, that could be very helpful. Go ahead.
Okay. It's 431-9251. That's 212.
Okay, you want to give it one more time?
Sure. 431-9251.
And that's a number for which?
That's actually the office of CISPES, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, which initiated this coalition, which is called the Emergency Coalition for Peace in El Salvador.
And those are the folks that, of course, got investigated by the FBI.
That's right.
For their patriotism. That's another thing I think that we should really be outraged at. Both what happened to CISPES, how long ago was that, a year or so, 2 years?
Revealed about a year and a half ago because of CISPES and the Center for Constitutional Rights pressing the issue and agitating to get their files under the Freedom of Information Act, which took a lawsuit for them to get that. But, of course, the surveillance had been going on, at least according to the documents, since the establishment of CISPES in 1980. And although the FBI is now claiming that this is a thing of the past and they've cleaned up their act, it's quite clear that the whole Central America Solidarity Movement still continues to fall under surveillance and disruption.
And let's not also forget, if this is claimed to be something in the past, then how come the exact same thing just happened to the librarians that raised a fuss over the FBI's proposal for librarians to work with them to try to find people that are reading things that they shouldn't be reading, or perhaps people with foreign-sounding last names that are reading things that could be harmful to this country. Some librarians objected to that, and a case was opened on each and every one of them. It's not something that's in the past.
Right, absolutely.
It's an ongoing thing. All right, thank you, sir, for calling. Thanks for passing on that information, and let's hope that there's something maybe reported in Prague that hundreds of thousands of people massed in the streets of New York to protest something that's unfair. Thanks for calling. 279-3400. Good evening.
Good evening.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello.
Go ahead. You're on.
Good. I would like to say that I concur with you entirely, or almost entirely. I want to just go and say to you that I was at rallies. I've been to the Mandela rally a year ago, and the recent one, to the Martin Luther King birthday rally, to the homelessness and housing rallies where we met at the Coliseum, and we went across 57th Street. That's three times, you know, 3 years. To the AIDS rally, to the one for the tree that was cut down where they had this giant redwood tree at the UN. To the Namibian rally, to the Abby Hoffman rally at the Bleecker Street Cinema when he had just died.
Okay, so apart from saying that there are a lot of rallies.
About the tuition.
Okay.
The Rainbow Rally, again, to. I want to just say that there are people who go to these rallies. I did miss the Salvadorian one, I must admit that. You know what I mean? For the record, I did miss that one. I wanted to get
there. We all missed it. If we blinked, we missed it. That's the problem.
What?
If you blinked, you could have missed it. That's the whole problem.
But
you know?
The point is that at all these rallies, how shall I say, except the housing one. The housing one had, at the last one, where we went across 57th Street, around 7,000 or 10,000 people. But when you stop to think of the millions of people in New York City, you know, you'd say to yourself, well, it'd be nice if there were a million people there. However, WBAI, which if it had a million subscribers, could amass $3 million. You see what I mean? If each person contributed just $3. Now, if 3 million New Yorkers gave a dollar, they could achieve, $3 million monies to work with. You know what I mean? Bob Fass made this point at one time.
Okay, but I mean, you obviously know the importance of WBAI. I know the importance of WBAI, but what we're talking here with the policy in El Salvador, we're talking about life and death. We're talking about something that's grossly unfair and is very likely to reach the stage of the Vietnam War if it continues unchecked.
Well, let me say this. This is low-intensity warfare, but it is another Vietnam. The whole world is another Vietnam. How the United States of America could have a person, if they had a choice between Mr. Bush and myself, they should have chosen me. If New York City had a choice between Mr. Dinkins or Mr. Koch or me, they should have chosen me. But the world, in a sense, it's like Murphy's Law, where the good is rejected, but the less good is highly acceptable. Do you see my point? This is one of the tragedies of the human condition. Hello?
Yeah, I see your point.
I would like to just continue. You may have heard Carletta's show, but I want you to know something, that my crying out against the restraint of a person, if he so or she so desired as an author, to mention the price of a book, and the what has happened to me on this station amongst supposedly civilized and sensitive audience.
That's...
What is happening in Salvador is no different than I have actually been personally told by Bob Fass that he would break my jaw and that he would...
Okay, I think we're straying just a slight bit from the subject here. 279-3400 is our telephone number. Good evening. Well, that's me, but hopefully there's another person there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead. It's delay. It's the wonderful world of delay, yes.
Hi, good evening, Mr. Goldstein. I heard your show once before. I really admired it, and I just want to know also, are you on the air ever aside from Mr. Wist's show?
Well, I'll be filling in two more times after this at this time slot, and after that, only God knows what I'll be doing, but I'll be doing something.
Because you really good. I just wanted to say, you know, I'm against the United States getting involved in El Salvador, but I just wanted to correct you on one thing when you just compared it to Libya. It's totally different. One is the government of El Salvador, whether we like it or not, I don't like it, was elected. And two, they invited us to help there as military advisors. I personally do not think we ought to get involved militarily in El Salvador, especially since the Iron Curtain has gone down. If there was an Iron Curtain there and they were being helped clandestinely through the Russians, I would be the number one for defending, you know, the Monroe Doctrine. But I don't think communism at this point, or leftists, is a big threat in El Salvador to us, even if they got elected. And I'm very nervous that we're going to get involved there, and I mean that we're going to get much heavier involved. And I personally think that now's the chance we can cut down our military budget and get back to the days prior to before we were, you know, the world's policemen. And, you know, if we have a CIA, they should be a listening device, not an active CIA going into different countries and doing things, just to listen to see, to protect us in case of something happens, so we should have ears.
Yeah, you know, I sense a kind of a dismay among many many people with all this glasnost and democratization in Eastern Europe. It's wait a minute, where are you guys going? Come back here. We still got some fighting to do. And I saw a cartoon I think it was the New York Times last Sunday, saying we have to stay in El Salvador. It's one of the few places left where we can fight communism.
Human nature does not like change, and you know most humans do not like change. You have some people, and it's good to have some of these people. Like for instance, Dan Quayle. He is very pessimistic. I mean, it's not, and it's good to have someone like him in the administration to keep things moderate. You know, because now Bush was big with glasses, and I think that's good. I think it's good, but you need the other side of the point of view. Like Madison, James Madison, always said, you need both sides of the equation for an even-handed policy. But another thing is, the reason why I haven't marched with El Salvador, I'm basically a libertarian conservative, and with these protesters, some of these protesters, I feel very uncomfortable with. For instance, we were at a cocktail party. This had to do with AIDS. I have delivered meals at one time every day to AIDS patients, but we had these protesters supposed to ACT UP. I don't know if you ever heard of them.
Oh, yes, certainly.
And we were at a fundraiser for George Bush, and they came in and they just started raising hell and screaming.
That's democracy. That's what happens. It gets messy.
The thing is, it actually gave everyone at the party a laugh, but when you looked at these people, I wouldn't want to sit there, and many of these people might be at the El Salvador rally, too. You know, they had, like, bleached blonde hair, and they were, like, spooky-looking people. They actually hurt their cause.
Yeah, but sir, look at New York City. Do you live in New York?
Yeah, I live in New York City, yes.
Look at all the people in New York. There's some people that you probably don't want to hang out with, yet that doesn't keep you from coming into the city. This is bigger than the personalities that you may see there. Yeah, you're not going to agree with everybody, and every movement has idiots, people that follow for no reason other than to be popular, that don't know what they're talking about. No movement is immune from that. So that's no reason not to be a part of it. If you believe in something, be there. And forget everybody else. Be there for yourself.
But I find a lot of these movements, I mean, I love America. For instance, if I were to protest, I'd be protesting not out of a hate for America and things like that. I mean,
of course not.
I mean, I'd be doing out of love, almost like a parent, not hitting a child, but almost like my patriotic duty. Like our founding fathers would be dumbfounded that we're getting involved in so many...
Of course they would. And what's annoying is the fact that the people who support this policy say that it's the patriotic thing to do, and they've got, you know, the flag behind them. You know, in Prague over the last couple of days, the one thing that you saw on the streets, almost as much as you saw the people, was the Czechoslovakian flag. And that is so right. I mean, that makes so much sense. It's the people saying something. They are the flag. If anything is a symbol, it's that. And any mass movement, any movement where people are calling for something in this country deserves the flag behind it.
Well, you got to remember something, that in this country, the reason why we're so complacent is because we've had democracy, we're adjusted to it, and a lot of these countries, they go too fast. For instance, France, mm-hmm. 1700s went very fast, and John Adams was like, yo, wait a minute, slow down, this is not such a great thing for them over there, because the way they handled, they went too quickly into it. We always went into it very slowly, and the thing is, I'm very scared of big government in any way. I mean, I think that I disagree with George Bush on his El Salvador policy, but I think he means well. I disagree with George Bush on his drug policy. I mean, I basically believe in a phased-in legalization of drugs, and George Bush doesn't. I mean, he believes in a very harsh policy, but I think deep down in his heart, he thinks he's doing the right thing. A lot of people, especially at these rallies, think they're purposely doing it, like, clandestinely and for evil motives. I don't think that. I just think that they're looking at it from a totally different angle.
But you know, another thing that everybody seems to assume, first of all, that these people are completely apart from the rest of the world, that they're superstars, and that there's no way that the average person can ever be in contact with these people or anything like that. That's, you know, that's a sickness. But the other thing that that folks seem to think is that the politicians and the leaders of governments are, you know, vastly intelligent people that know exactly what to do in a crisis. You know, to a degree that may be true, but they're not smarter than a lot of us. They just know what it is they want to accomplish, and they have the means to do it. And that's what sets them apart. And unfortunately, it's us that sets them apart more than they are.
Every president except for Gerald Ford since Herbert Hoover.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Every president except Gerald Ford, since Herbert Hoover's time, has been very distant from the people. I mean, and the reason why is security reasons for Secret Service keep them away. Prior to Herbert Hoover, people were able to go over to the president, and you know he was with everyday the common man. The reason why Ford was such a good president because he was in Congress. He was elevated to the presidency so quickly.
Right, but I've seen things over the last few weeks with Gorbachev, with Egon Krenz, where people are shouting at them and he's responding. Recently in Chicago, somebody shouted a question about the El Salvador policy to George Bush, and they were ushered out of the room.
That's what I'm trying to say, is that there's a difference between shouting and sitting down and chatting.
Except you can't sit down and chat. They won't let you do that, you see?
That's what I'm saying. That's very bad. This is what's the destruction of the president. This is what killed Lyndon Johnson, and this is what killed a lot of presidents, and Nixon especially. But even is that it's become so imperial. Even people who like, let's say, I happen to like Bush, but, I mean, I could not go over to George Bush. There'd be a Secret Service. I mean, even to talk with him, chat with him on a friendly-type basis, not even on a hostile basis. I think it's very damaging to him himself because he doesn't get the feel of the common man. That's what I was trying to say, is that that presidents since Herbert Hoover, I mean, aside from Ford, they've never had interaction really with the common man. They're always with their advisors or planned, scheduled group of people. I think that's very dangerous.
That certainly is, especially it happens to any celebrity. I mean, I know celebrities that have complained vigorously of not being able to walk down the street, and it's really a sad thing. But when you have somebody in a position of power, it becomes dangerous because that person thinks they know what we want, and perhaps they don't.
Well, George Washington was a celebrity in his day, believe me, and people still would, I mean, that was a problem. People used to walk into his house and just sit there and start talking to him. People still, he would walk down the street, and people would be able to approach him. I mean, and these people were not, peasant farmers. These were aristocratic people, but they still touched and they spoke with the common man. I mean, that is very, and you know, you don't know what to do because for security reasons you have to keep people away from the president, so you don't know. It's like a catch-22 type situation.
But why in God's name can't we have a real debate when it's election time? Why do we have to have this structured garbage that where the two candidates don't even talk to each other? You know, at least give us that.
I have to agree with you. I mean, like this was more to the more local with the Giuliani and Dinkins debate. I mean, Giuliani, I was very upset with Giuliani. I mean, Dinkins had a lot of negative stuff, but Giuliani, I felt, should have concentrated on his positive instead of concentrating so much on the negative. I mean, you bring up the negative, fine, but also bring up the positive with the Bush campaign. I mean, I supported Bush. I mean, I still support Bush, but I think there are a lot of things lacking in Bush and anyone, whether it was Bush or Dukakis, is because they're so far removed from the people. No human being, if I were to come over and shout at you something like those people in El Salvador, even if you're correct, just the approach of it is very alarming. That's human nature. So I can understand the president's reaction to it, even though I disagree with his ideas. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do, but still, I sense more suppression of ideas here than in other places, in other countries where things are happening now, where there is change. If somebody were to shout out a question, they might be told to be quiet, but the question would be answered. Here, the person is ushered out, the president makes some kind of a joke, and that's it. It's all over, and everybody laughs and applauds and feels patriotic.
Well, that's for a momentary purpose, those countries in Eastern Europe. I mean, I don't know long term what's going to happen with them. I mean, you know, because they might move so rapid that they might move back again. You know,
right, but you see, that they're at the crest of something exciting, which we were once at. And it's at times like that the government is closest to the people, whether it's the people throwing them out or the people ushering them in. There's contact there, and you have to somehow preserve that contact.
Oh, I agree, and I think that this country, I mean, we might lose it, might ebb down, but it'll come back. I mean, if you look at the from the 40s, and then in the 60s it was a movement. I mean, I didn't necessarily, I don't know, I was too young at the time, I'm only 26, I don't know if I would have agreed at the time what these people in the 60s did. Now, in hindsight, of course, I think many of what these so-called radical hippies, many of them had ideas that were, believe it or not, very similar to our founding fathers, which might surprise a lot of people if there were some ideas that were, that movement came up that was a homespun idea. It was a grassroots movement in the 60s. So here you had a very complacent 1950s society, even had McCarthyism, which almost destroyed our democracy and our whole form of government. And then on top, then the 60s came. So I think Americans do fight it off. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think so. Well, you're saying that eventually things will work themselves out. But
right.
I think it's not quite that simple if we don't take an active role. In other words, we don't do things like demonstrate against something that we think is unfair and, you know why that we're demonstrating, not just go because it's the thing to do, but think about it. Sit down, think about it a little bit and say, you know, this is not right. Look at the papers, read the papers. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I know that take pride in saying, you know, it's been 2 weeks since I've read a newspaper. I don't even know what's going on in the world. It's like, how can you be proud of something like that? Only in America do I see things like this. Especially in a country that has such an effect on the rest of the world. The rest of the world looks to us for...
These men who took the time, and you have that in every society, especially in democratic society. I mean, the Greeks forced their people to participate, and that's why one of the reasons they downfall was just too much.
Well, apathy will do it to you every time.
Well, apathy, but there's still enough people, I think, to arouse, and I think that when things are like with the whole My Lai incident, that aroused people's anger. I mean, I know this from history, not from being there at the time. Nixon did pardon the man, but I mean, that aroused anger.
As well it should.
Similarly, it was in a very isolated incident to what happened in Nazi Germany, and we did not allow it.
See, what I sense here today is we must avoid talking about things that will get us into arguments. And I say, why? Why avoid these things? Why not plunge right into an argument and know what it is we're arguing for and discuss things? You know, we don't discuss things enough here, and there are so many things happening. And we really have to take a stand on some of these things.
That's the problem. You have a large government. I mean, I'm not just talking about, for instance, this National Endowment for the Arts. Take that for an example. Now,
sure.
I don't like when it was first being proposed. Most people in the most moderate and conservative people said we don't want it. And the reason why we don't want this is because then the government's going to tell people how to do art. Then there's only going to be moderate art. And it's, believe it or not, so happens that it's the conservative Republicans. I wouldn't even say conservative, I would say fascistic Republicans, because Jesse Helms is not your typical Republican, who's put these sanctions on the National Endowment. And when you take things from the government like that, they, in a sense, have a right to tell you what to do. Maybe that's why I'm against all these government programs. Government has grown too big. In emergencies, you do need government to get big. But right now, we don't need such a large government. That's why they have such control over the media and things like that. The media is not as investigative enough also.
Well, that's certainly true, and I think they certainly should be. Listen, sir, I'm going to try to get on some more calls.
Have a good night, and keep up the good work. I hope you get your own programs.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Our number is 279-3400, and, you know, I was thinking the other day of all the things that we've been accusing the Eastern European governments of doing, and I'm not America bashing here. This is just objective thinking, and if your reaction is to say that somebody who comes up with these thoughts is anti-American, then I think you should think about just what is America, and why it is that we can't question the values and what's being done, and perhaps. If you automatically assume that someone who criticizes is anti-American, perhaps that's the most subtle form of anti-Americanism in itself. In any event, what I was thinking was sort of a collection of all the different things that that we used to accuse the Soviets of doing. Things like shutting people up all the time, not allowing debates. Well, we've heard it from the president. There'll be no more debates, and things like sending up secretive space missions. Well, now we do that too. You know, we send up these space shuttles. We don't tell anybody when they're going up. We have no media coverage, at least not very good media coverage, and all these other things, controlling of the art, like the gentleman on the phone just mentioned, actually cutting off funds to an art exhibit because it was, quote, too political, as if politics has no place in the art world. Little things like that, little steps, you know, little symptoms of a society that that looks ever more with ever increasing hostility towards any form of dissent. And here we see sort of a flip-flop, you know? We see change. We see dialogue over there. And here, silence. It's kind of scary. 279-3400. Good morning.
Hello?
Yeah. Did I wake you up?
Is this WBA?
Yes, it is. You're on.
Okay.
Right, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The thing that I wanted to talk about is how incredibly interesting the coverage on Eastern Europe has been in the major media. It used to be when, say, during the Brezhnev era, when it seemed like there was no hope for positive change in authoritarian socialist countries. The standard line is these countries are totalitarian, they're incapable of any positive change short of a violent revolution. The Jean Kirkpatrick line.
Mm-hmm.
And now that the countries are going through positive change, the established media in this country only says this means that communism doesn't work. But they don't. It seems like they purposely are trying to avoid what the leaders of those opposition movements believe in, what they're about. For instance, in East Germany, there were some very interesting articles in the Village Voice about the oppositionists, such as, you know, the New Forum Party. Well, not the New Forum Movement, rather than the New Forum Party. It's not a political party. And it appears that the major thrust of the oppositionists in East Germany is really towards a democratic, humane form of socialism. It's not towards a capitalist economy. Matter of fact, the leaders of the opposition in East Germany wrote some sort of manifesto, and in the manifesto they actually criticized Hungarian steps towards a market economy, saying that it's really promoted in egalitarianism and it was not fair to the poorer people in Hungary. And it's just kind of interesting how the media is handling it.
Well, you know, you might find this interesting, the fact that there has been a lot of coverage of things like the scaling of the Berlin Wall and the events in Prague, but I read someplace where the actual ratings for that particular news coverage were the lowest ever, as if the people in this country couldn't care less about that what was going on over there, and I found that kind of dismaying too. You know,
I don't know why it should be so dismaying. I mean, in regards to oppression going on in the world, the oppression of people in Eastern Europe compares nothing to the oppression of people living in capitalist countries in the third world.
Yeah, well, I mean,
there's just absolutely no comparison.
You see, I think that phrase would probably turn off people that are pro-capitalist, but I don't see why it should, because it's to everyone's advantage who lives in a capitalist society to see that that it works somehow. You know, if you're a capitalist and there's oppression going on because of capitalism someplace, that should affect you, and you should want to change that. And that's what I think is happening in all kinds of places all over the world.
Yeah, but you know, it's very questionable whether capitalism in the undeveloped countries really can do much for the average citizen in improving their lives. I mean, there's some examples that are used, such as South Korea. I don't really know much about the standard of living in South Korea, but you know, some of the examples that the establishment has previously used in this country as kind of models for development of third world countries such as Brazil. It ends up, even though Brazil had very high economic growth, there's an incredible amount of poverty and malnutrition in that country. Cuba, on the other hand, for all its flaws, and I'm certainly not a defender of the authoritarian brand of socialism there, I think in many ways it may have been imposed by the unnecessary hostility on the part of the most powerful military country in the world, the United States, seems to have the highest standard of living in Latin America, if you're judging standard of living.
Right. Well, they have a higher standard of living at the expense of some things, which some people would say is intolerable, some people would say is a necessary trade-off. Now, I think, you know, we're making a big mistake here if we just watch all these changes taking place in Eastern Europe and say, hey, you know, they're taking on Western ways, they're embracing democratic reforms, without us taking a good hard look at our own system and saying, well, maybe there's something we can learn from what they tried to do or what they are trying to do now. And, you know, the people there have no objection to taking on ways that are alien to their society, you know, taking on capitalist type of means of doing things or democratic reforms, that kind of thing. But if you say to anybody here, let's try, you know, a socialist way of dealing with this particular problem to see how that works, it's, oh my God, no, socialism, communism, oh, it's horrible. You know, we're the most powerful country in the world. Why are we so scared of trying out something in a slightly different way? You know, and that's what we have to get across, is that fear, that horrible fear of change, a fear of anything different, which is the basis of any kind of hatred and nationalism, all that nasty stuff, you know?
The thing about democracy is it's a very nebulous and vague term. However, democracy, whatever that means exactly, does not really... There doesn't seem to be any real conflict or contradiction between socialism and democracy. Just as capitalism can exist in many different forms, there can be authoritarian capitalism, as certainly practiced many places in the world, such as El Salvador, and it was practiced in Nazi Germany, even though some people think that was a socialist economy, but it was essentially a capitalist economy. The Nazis really didn't... in essence, saved German capitalism, and
mm-hmm.
you know, capitalism before the, you know, what Marxists would call the bourgeois revolution, such as the American Revolution and the French Revolution, certainly had dictatorial governments. So, you know, just as capitalism can exist in, you know, with varying governmental forms, so can socialism. It's just, I think socialism is a very young system, and it's met with a lot of external resistance from without powerful capitalist countries.
Well, you know, I would even hasten to say that many of the enemies of socialism came from within socialism itself. You could say, you know, the United States has been an enemy of socialism, but I would also say that the oppressors, the Nikolai Ceausescus, the Leonid Brezhnevs, perhaps, maybe even the Mao Zedongs, are actual enemies of socialism because they would introduce oppression, totalitarianism type of things that give socialism a bad name and make the people want something else and maybe lose track of what it is that they fought for in the first place. Anyway, sir, I want to thank you for calling. We are taking more phone calls at 279-3400. You're listening to WBAI in New York. And we're looking at an article here by Robert E. White. Remember Robert E. White? I do. He was the former U.S. ambassador to El Salvador from 1977 to 1980. But what was particularly interesting about him was the fact that he would say all these things about how the United States is really messing things up over there by their policy, even while he was part of the policy, even while he was part of the United States government representing us in El Salvador. It was incredible. I had never seen such a thing, and it was quite a surprise. But it was no surprise when he got sacked, and he was ambassador from 1977 to 1980. Right now he's president of the International Center for Development Policy, and perhaps in the coming weeks we'll have him as a guest. I certainly would hope so. This is a piece that he had in the Times about a week ago on the opinion page, and I think it bears listening to, because this is somebody that's been there. This is somebody that obviously knows something about the policy, the country, the people, and where it's all leading. The history of El Salvador bears consistent witness to the greed and brutality of men who look on compromise as weakness and who regard torture and murder as routine and acceptable methods of coping with dissent. The failure of U.S. policymakers to press for a negotiated end to the war in El Salvador has placed our country in league with a clique of assassins, masquerading as an army. The war in El Salvador entered a new phase last week, actually 2 weeks ago, when the left-wing Farabunda Marti National Liberation Front, or FMLN, angered by government rejection of their peace proposals, launched its heaviest offensive of the war. If revolutionary leaders thought this impressive show of strength would lead quickly to negotiations, they miscalculated. To the Salvadoran military, the rebel attacks came as a gift, an opportunity to wipe out not only insurgents, but also priests, labor union organizers, peasant leaders, and thousands of poor citizens who support change. On November 16th, 1989, armed, uniformed men dragged 6 Jesuit priests and 2 servants from their beds. They tortured the priests for close to an hour, then executed all their captives. The Catholic University, where these priests lived and worked, is under 24-hour surveillance by the security forces and is located in a zone far away from the fighting. To their credit, both President Alfredo Cristiani and the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Bernard Aronson have acknowledged that right-wing forces probably bear responsibility for these barbaric murders. They never would have made such statements without evidence. Through its intelligence assets inside the Salvadoran military, the U.S. Embassy can find out which officers carried out these crimes. Unless the U.S. reacts strongly, the lives of all priests, nuns, and Protestant missionaries who work with the poor of Central America are in jeopardy. The highly professional U.S. ambassador to El Salvador, William Walker, misspoke when he stated that whoever killed the Jesuits did the work of the FMLN. Whoever killed those priests did the work of the military death squads, the same people who assassinated Archbishop Oscar Arnolfo Romero, the same who violated and murdered 4 American churchwomen and massacred hundreds of priests, nuns, and lay workers. There is little tolerance inside the ruling Arena Party and the hardline military for Mr. Cristiani's commitment to a negotiated solution to the war. In the sick minds of men like the former death squad leader Roberto Dabrisson, Mr. Cristiani is only a figurehead. Arena's 1988 campaign chant tells the story: Cristiani to the presidency, Dabrisson to power. Day after day, the world watches with horror as modern engines of war supplied by the U.S. strafe, bomb, and burn the shanty towns of San Salvador, maiming and killing thousands of innocent civilians. They do little damage to the pockets of mobile guerrillas armed only with handheld weapons. The government has denied Red Cross requests for a ceasefire to evacuate the wounded. No civilized people can support such a war without inflicting substantial moral harm on its own body politic. The leaders of our nation have never made any plausible case that U.S. security benefits in any way from this continuing slaughter. President Bush described the Salvadoran revolutionaries as terrorists and the Salvadoran government as a democracy. Wrong on both counts. The revolutionaries took up arms only after the military and economic elites of El Salvador had rejected all avenues of peaceful change for more than half a century. No competent observer doubts that the Salvadoran Revolution is homegrown, authentic, and enjoys wide popular support. The revolutionaries have made serious proposals for a negotiated end to the conflict. In response to their well-thought-out peace plan, the reply was, "The government of El Salvador will not give an inch." Their demand that the military purge itself of its most notorious abusers of human rights was derided as absurd, ridiculous, and impossible. The composition of the armed forces was not negotiable. A week ago, the House, at the request of Mr. Bush, rejected efforts to restrict military aid to El Salvador. The outdated security doctrine that guides Bush administration thinking demands the subordination of El Salvador's need for social and economic justice to our supposed national security requirements. This has meant the establishment of a veneer of democracy in El Salvador, where the armed forces, with U.S. acquiescence, decide with deadly force who can and cannot participate in political life. In El Salvador, the fundamental duty of a democratic government to protect its citizens has been stood on its head. People are tortured, disappear, and are killed at the whim of security forces that enjoy absolute immunity from legal action. The guerrillas are not trying to shoot their way into power. They are trying to shoot their way into serious negotiations. The Salvadoran government would not survive for 1 month without U.S. support. If the Bush administration had used this leverage to ensure good faith discussions, the tragedies of these last few weeks might never have occurred. That piece from Robert E. White, former U.S. ambassador to El Salvador. Worth thinking about. Again, there is a rally in New York this Saturday, beginning at 11 o'clock. If you think the U.S. policy in El Salvador needs a bit of fixing. Our phone number is 279-3400, and we'll be right back.
A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. A handle hit out in the dark. A hand set the spark. Two eyes took the aim behind a man's brain. But he can't be blamed. He's only a pawn in their game. The South politician preaches to the poor white man. You got more than the blacks, don't complain. You're better than them. You've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. The deputy sheriffs, the soldiers, the governors get paid. And the marshals and cops get the same. But the poor white man's used in the hands of them all like a tool. He's taught in his school from the start by the rule that the laws are with him to protect his white skin, to keep up his heat, so he never thinks straight about the shape that he's in. But it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. From the poverty shacks, he looks from the cracks to the tracks. And the hoofbeats pound in his brain. And he's taught how to walk in a pack, shoot in the back with his fist in a clinch. To hang and to lynch, to hide neath the hood,
to kill with no pain, like a dog on a chain. He ain't got no name, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. Today, Medgar Evers was buried from the bullet he caught. They're lowering him down as a king. But when the shadowy sun sets on the one that fired the gun, you'll see by his grave, on the stone that remains, carved next to his name, his epitaph plain, only a pawn in their game.
Crash, another six-man burn.
Troubled, all messed up, this whole wide world of ours. That's Dennis Brown here on WBAI in New York. And we heard from Big Audio Dynamite with the story of the drug bandit of Brazil, which doesn't really tie into El Salvador blatantly, but I think you can see a few parallels there if you look a little bit. And we, that song incidentally was called Samba Drum, and we heard from Bob Dylan up on top. From The Times They Are A-Changing, and the times are always a-changing. That's the marvelous thing about it. And what's even more marvelous is that the time is in our hands. I mean, it sounds like a sickening kind of saying that gets said all the time, but it's really true. You know, it's something that we have the ultimate control over. And right now, you can be a part of things. You can be a part of things at this very moment in time by simply calling us 279-3400 and spouting your various rhetoric on the air. But there'll be no retributions, and that's a promise. In the bigger sense, be a part of things on Saturday when there'll be a demonstration in New York. You don't have to be a communist to go. You don't have to be a socialist to go. You don't have to be anything to go except a human being that thinks enough is enough. Or even a human being that just wants to learn and perhaps decide later after talking to a lot of people. You know, it's an educational experience. That's what life is supposed to be about. It's at least what I read in the instructions. Good evening.
Good evening and good morning. If you don't address the situation at WBAI, where a station manager is paid a salary to do a job and then is not at the station because she's in Asia, Southern Asia, doing a thesis, hello? If you don't address this as a fundamental issue of American democracy at home, or you are worthwhile conversation about distant things, which aren't so distant, are not valid, are not worthwhile, because the thing is, you're allowing an insidious disease to rage and desecrate this very wonderful institution. Now, Rosemary Reed is paid a salary. One, she doesn't listen, she doesn't get tapes of what's going on. The situations that have occurred to me as a result of my concern for freedom of speech, where the price, which was a fact, was asked to be denied to the public. Even Samori Marksman, a wonderful person, I like him very much, says, we're not going to mention the price of this thing, and then we're also not going to tape record any material from this discussion of Germany, because it's that way. And it's simply that way, he said. And I'm supposed to buy this?
I love radio. We can just fade people away. I wish life was like that. Well, anyway. Oh, thank you. He closed the door on the way out, too. I don't know what's going on out there, folks, but please try to stick to the subject. You know, we're talking about El Salvador. We're talking about world events. I don't want to hear about BAI events, you know? I mean, okay, it's a radio station. We have all kinds of things going on here, but I don't know about that right now, and I don't want to get involved in that right now. I want to talk about the issue at hand, and let's stop bickering about these minor little things. prices of books, for God's sake. 279-3400. I guess I should have said it before. Call up if you have something to say. Good evening. Good morning, rather.
How are you?
Okay.
You know, I've been a communist for a long time.
Uh-huh.
I was about 15. I'm like 28 now. And to me, the events in Eastern Europe are consistent with Marxist thesis of the coming dictatorship of the proletariat and the withering of the state. You know, so I'm not surprised when I watch those things. I get rather bored after a while because I just see the historical program working itself out, which the American media is apparently oblivious to.
What is that historical program?
The historical program of Marxist thesis of the coming dictatorship of the proletariat after a period of socialism.
Okay, I mean, I know that, but can you translate that into, you know, common talk here so that, what does that specifically mean in the 20th century?
Specifically, it means that the events that we see from Poland to Czechoslovakia are the actual facts of Marx's predictions, which he wrote in the Communist Manifestos and various other texts, which if people care to read, they will more or less get world events of the future written at some point in the late 19th century and thereabouts. And also, I guess I wanted to say that I wanted to project further into the United States, and I wanted to ask your feeling about the idea of coming in the coming decade, you know, a mass consensus in the United States to overthrow the government, taking into account historical trends. And, you know, do you feel that, you know, given that kind of event, there would be a consequent backlash to a super authoritarianism, which is only hinted at now by extreme conservatism? And the reason why I say these things, because when I started listening to you, two phrases occurred to me. One was, the old line that history repeats itself. And the second was, the Marxist line that, those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. So if we learn our history, we don't have to repeat it, but we would then be in a position to know what was coming.
Well, you know, I think there's a key there. I think that if we don't take an active interest in the past, and if we don't somehow link with the past, either through reading, which is something that that certainly has gone down the tubes over the last couple of decades in this country, or by studying history, by seeing the parallels, by seeing how going into one particular episode in history is very similar to what we're doing in the present, and how, you know, things could repeat themselves. If we don't do that, then in fact we are doomed to go through the same thing over and over again. And I'll say this: it's fascinating to watch the unfolding events overseas. But at the same time, it's disturbing because we're sort of backing away from the precipice of World War III, of nuclear annihilation and everything like that. But
that's depressing?
No, that's not depressing at all. But what's depressing is, or, you know, worthy of some concern, is the fact that we're also backing away from what brought us there in the first place. And I'm just wondering, maybe in 20 years we've forgotten the danger, the fear of living in the nuclear age, some minor thing could spark it all over again, and we'll just jump into it perhaps even more quickly without realizing what it was that we learned. If we don't keep up with the past, in other words, if the future generations are as disinterested in us as we are in the past generations, what will they learn from this? Absolutely nothing, and we won't have accomplished anything. So that's why we can't break that link with the past, you see.
Well, what strikes me as very interesting is that not very long ago, I was rummaging through an older friend's filing cabinet, and I came across
with that person's permission, I hope,
a political manifesto of the Weather Underground.
Uh-huh.
And I pulled it out and immediately became engrossed, and it was like an alien entity from outer space. To my friends, to people that I brought the subject up to, they were like, "What are you talking about?" They thought I was talking about something on cable or anything. They had no conception of the Weather Underground.
The Weather Channel, surprised. Right?
But if I gorge myself on that kind of information, and people activate their memory of not only the 60s, but, you know, of history, European history or world history, through whatever distorted sources they can get it through, they will, there will be a community of souls, as I like to call it. And that may, the soulless ones are the ones that I would fear, because they're the ones who would be in power, but they're also the ones who would become disempowered. I think their fear would paralyze them, but I'm not sure if it would paralyze them to forgive,
mm-hmm.
or whether it would paralyze them to react. But if say, an old man in the White House is weak and a young man is strong, that old man will push his red button, because that is the only strength that he has against the moral weight of the young man.
And if the old man is impotent, perhaps that would also, there's all kinds of things
and
there.
And you push the red button, too, but you
right.
have to be a madman.
But it's not inconceivable, you see. But also, I don't know if one person has that much power, the way things are now. But certainly, it's dangerous to give that much power to even, 12 people.
Well, if
however many.
The person, the power of the media, you can give an individual an enormous degree of power.
Sure. Yeah, through the media, you can give somebody more power than they ever would have ordinarily, definitely.
Mm-hmm. The media can more or less serve as a shield in itself, a suit of armor against public opinion, or a way to sway public opinion.
Yeah, I mean, the media itself is untouchable. I mean, people cannot walk up to, I'm not going to pick on anybody in particular, but, a TV anchorman and tell him what they think. And, they can't go up to a radio station, except for maybe WBAI, and say what's on their minds. It's untouchable. You can't reach it. It's just, it speaks down to you for the most part. And that's sad. The average person, I'll tell you, to be honest, I don't know very many average people. Most of the people that I know are heavily into this kind of thing. But I'm just, I imagine a mob of millions of people out there that have no access to any of this stuff, and they just read the paper, they read what's being said to them, but they don't talk back, they don't say anything back, and that's so sad, that's so scary, because there's nothing more harmful than a public that doesn't react, that just sort of the silent majority, I guess, is that old phrase.
Well, there is some harm in a public that merely reacts as well. On the other hand, I think it's like what they call, the silent majority. You have to, of just holding it in, not saying anything, just keeping your eyes closed and hoping that it all goes away. After a while, you have nothing left but your reaction.
Mm-hmm. Or not even hoping that it'll go away, just ignoring it altogether and not even knowing it's there,
Then I guess you just sort of step in it as you go along. Well, your show is, I must be honest with you, though, I'm...